From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is Which Way LA.
High-speed rail and technological leadership. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. California's high-speed rail project threatens California's financial future, according to a high-powered review board which recommends that it be delayed. Will the report itself make it harder to raise needed money? Has California lost the vision required to maintain its worldwide technological leadership? Also tonight, another bid for the Dodgers from Big Money and one of baseball's most highly regarded veterans. Later on, Iowa's over. Let the campaign begin. First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. The Iowa caucuses failed to produce a clear winner, and it's on to New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Florida before the end of this month. Later on, we'll look at last night's results and what might be in store for Republicans who want to be president. First, another bid to buy the Dodgers from Frank McCourt. LA developer Rick Caruso, who created The Grove in LA's Fairfax District and Glendale's Americana at Brand, has joined forces with Joe Torre, who managed the Dodgers after taking the Yankees to four World Series championships. Tom Hofarth is sports columnist at the Daily News, and Tom, it's good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
This is a pretty high-powered combo, and yet there are some other pretty high-powered combos in this race as well.
Yeah, but as I'm trying to size up all the people who have thrown their hat in the ring, I kind of like this one the most because it's got the Joe Torre presence, the stability, the leadership of the team that's already been there, and Caruso seems to have a great track record of things that he's done in L.A. so far. So if I were to put them on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd give them a 9 right now as far as leading the race as to who would I think would be the best fit for ownership at this point.
Joe Torre, of course, has resigned as a vice president of baseball operations for Major League Baseball. Does that job, having had that job, give him a leg up?
I think it really does because I remember back in April when the Dodgers were taken over by Tom Schieffer, who kind of was the Bud Selig, the commissioner's appointed person. And Joe Torre was at that press conference, and I remember talking to you about this then, that Joe was kind of there in the background, and he was going to help Schieffer sort of guide Major League Baseball through this whole process. So now it kind of comes to light how Joe was sort of maybe positioning himself for this all along. And who better to know Bud Selig and how things work in the commissioner's office than Joe, who's been there, you know, for the last year. And I think the fact that he resigned his position gives a statement that he's pretty confident that he could be part of this winning team.
So some of the other big names involved in this in different bids are Mark Cuban, who owns the Dallas Mavericks, Orel Hershiser and Steve Garvey, of course, both former Dodgers, Peter O'Malley, who owned the Dodgers at one point, the general manager Fred Clair, or former general manager Fred Clair. He's in another one from Peter O'Malley. And Magic Johnson has a bid in.
Right, and Larry King is also involved, and with Dennis Gilbert, who I think has a pretty decent shot. I think he's got to be in the top three or four of those who can do it. And Magic Johnson, I think he's aligned himself pretty well with some people who've got the money and the baseball experience to do this. But after those three, I don't think there's going to be much depth behind a bid by Hershiser or Fred Clair or even Mark Cuban, who I think knows that it's going to cost more than $1 billion to get involved in this. Plus, there's going to be so much debt involved that Mark is a pretty smart businessman. He just doesn't want to throw his money away like that. But I think the other people who are involved all have sort of something else at stake, whether it's a bid for a mayor job somewhere down the road or, you know, something that they want to get done in the city. I think this is sort of their entryway into sort of being, who's going to be the savior of Los Angeles and by the Dodgers.
Rick Caruso, of course, has indicated from time to time that he would like to be a mayor, but it sounds like an awfully expensive way to go about it.
It's kind of the way of a baseball owner, too. I don't think most of them are in it to make money. It's more of an ego thing, and especially the Dodgers, it's not going to be a get-rich-quick scheme the way that they're set up with all this debt. And Magic Johnson has had overtures of being mayor someday, too. So I think there's a lot of politics involved in who you're aligned with at this point and who which horse you're going to ride in this race.
What about the television rights? Isn't that a lot of the asset? And hasn't the bankruptcy court said they could be sold before the team is?
Yeah, that's going to be a lot to determine about how much money can be coming in. And that's a whole other issue that it sort of fell through after the McCourts went through bankruptcy, and now Fox does not own the exclusive window to re-up. So Time Warner Cable could come in and offer billions of dollars in TV rights. And I'm kind of surprised at this point that Time Warner hasn't formed a group that would actually try to buy the Dodgers. And maybe that'll be coming up, because the bids have until January 23rd now. The deadline was extended, so they still have time to make some sort of a formal bid.
When you rank them as you have, what are the two main things that you look at?
I think the knowledge of how baseball works and I don't think Frank McCourt was a great fit to start with, and now that they're kind of doing a do-over at this point, those who are really connected with the inside of baseball is going to have a great insight into getting something done with Bud Selig and his group. And I think the other thing is you've got to look past the star power of a lot of these things and really who has a lot of money and who can do things. Once they buy the team, you're still going to have to make improvements probably to the stadium and to facilities and buying free agent players like that. So you don't want somebody who's going to just lose all their income right away and just in buying the team. You want somebody with stability. And that... And one of the kind of the wild cards in this has been this hedge fund owner from the East Coast, Steve Cohen, who's got a group together, and he's got the endorsement of Eli Brode and David Geffen. So he could be the one who has the most money, and that could be the one that Frank McCourt eventually picks to own the team based on the fact that he could afford it the most.
So you can talk about how baseball works and all that stuff, but Frank McCourt wants to get his money back, right?
Exactly, and he's got a lot of debt he's got to cover, and I'd be surprised if he broke even in this whole thing based on how much money he's already spent and how much money he owes to different people. So there is the fact, too, that he's might be just selling the team and the stadium and still own a lot of the land at the parking revenue. So he could still be a piece in this whole picture once the ownership is determined.
Okay, the deadline for bids, January 23rd. A lot could happen between now and then, and a lot could happen after that. Tom Hofarth, good to talk with you again. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Warren.
Sports columnist for the Los Angeles Daily News and the Los Angeles News Group. I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
You're listening to Which Way LA from KCRW. Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/whichwayla or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter at WWLA.
We're on back with Which Way LA. California's High-Speed Rail Project and the California High-Speed Rail Peer Review Group were created by state voters in Proposition 1A. The review group is a high-powered panel that provides the legislature with progress reports on the multi-billion dollar system to link the state's major cities. Its latest report is a dire warning. The project represents an immense financial risk to California because there are no credible sources of adequate funding. That's a quote. The Rail Authority says the report is flawed and that just releasing it will create a cloud threatening the very support the review group finds lacking. One member of the review group is Lou Thompson. He's a transportation policy consultant from Northern California. Mr. Thompson, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Warren.
As I understand it, you're a high-speed rail fan. You'd like to see this done. Why, then, would you sign on to a report that might, in and of itself, make it more difficult to get the money you say they need?
I find it hard to believe that potential investors wouldn't do their own analysis and do their own thinking with $98 billion at stake. The report is either right or it's wrong, but if it's right, then it should be considered. If it's wrong, I'm sure that the private sector can figure that out.
Support your finding.
Support my finding.
Yeah. Why is it that you say there are no credible sources of adequate funding?
Because there are none. The only source available to the authority right now is the federal ARRA money and the California bond fund, and after that, there is nothing. There are no federal programs that would provide money. There are no state programs that would provide money, and there are no private investors available as of now.
The California bonds would be about $9 billion, is that right?
In total, of which nearly $3 billion would be spent at this stage, and the other $6 billion would remain, but it must have a match or it cannot be spent.
And you're saying the total cost is in the neighborhood of $98 billion. How much has the federal government put up so far?
The federal government has put up about $3 billion so far.
And is that in trouble also because of Republicans who want to freeze it?
I don't believe that amount is in trouble, but I do know that the Republicans have essentially prevented any further funding as of now.
Okay, Lou Thompson again, a principal at Thompson, Gallinson & Associates in Saratoga and a member of the High Speed Rail Peer Review Group. Tom Umberg is a former Democratic Assemblyman. He's chair now of the board of the California High Speed Rail Authority. Tom Umberg, always good to have you back on our program.
Thank you, Warren. And Lou, good to be with you also.
Good to talk to you, Tom.
What do you say, Mr. Umberg? It was you that I cited when I said that there's concern that the report itself will cause a problem raising the money. But Mr. Thompson says the problem is the money's just not there.
Well, let me put this in a bit of context, is that California's population is going to be 50 million by the year 2030, an increase about the size of the state of New York, number one. Number two is that our transportation infrastructure is already strained. So we've got to do something to deal with the current problem and then deal with the additional number of people. There are several ways to deal with it. One is we could build more freeway miles, about 2,300. We could build 115 new airport gates or four new runways, if that were feasible. Or we could engage, as the voters have directed us, in a project to link Northern and Southern California through a high-speed rail system. In building that system, we have, as Lou pointed out, we have $6 billion currently in hand. There's no infrastructure project in California and probably in the United States that's had its total funding already in pocket at the time of its initial construction. This is a project that's going to take us till 2033. Now, by 2021, we will have linked two portions of California so that people can use high-speed rail. And to do that, we need an additional about $18 billion in addition to the money that we've identified right now. We don't need any additional funding until after the year 2015, and the president has made this one of his top infrastructure priorities. The president has instituted legislation to create an infrastructure bank, if you will, or trust fund. So we also know that once we've built the operational part of the system, meaning the part of the system where people can actually ride, that the private sector is very, very interested. But killing the project now by urging the legislature to not begin makes it all impossible.
Well, you said that the total funding is in hand. How do you explain that statement when $98 billion is the total cost?
Well, $98 billion is the total cost in 2033. And that's using a 3% inflation rate, a $16 billion contingency, which is very, if you will, conservative. Our inflation rate right now is much, much lower than that. But in order for the private sector to invest, in the year 2021, we'll have linked two portions of California, and that's when the private sector will come in.
So with the money on hand, you can link two portions of California?
With the money on hand, we can build 130 miles of track right now. With the additional funding provided by the bond, we then need about another $18 billion to link to Los Angeles, which over the course of the next 10 years is doable. We recognize we have challenges, and there's no project, whether it was the aqueduct here or the build-out of the University of California campuses, there's no project that has all the funding identified up front. But if we don't start very soon, we lose the federal funding, number one. Number two is that the increased population development increases the cost of the system by $2 to $3 billion a year. So if we say, let's wait 10 years, we're increasing the cost by $20 billion by just waiting.
We've been hearing from Tom Umberg, who's chair of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. Now back to Lou Thompson, who's with the High-Speed Rail Peer Review Group. What do you say to all that? If we don't get going, it's going to be harder than ever.
Well, our objective was not to say that the project should go or not go. And, in fact, if you read what we said, we did not say that the project should be disapproved. What we said was that the legislature and the people of California have to be well aware of what the risks are in this project. If it is undertaken today with no funding in hand beyond that which is available, then the legislature and the state will face a pretty difficult choice a couple of years from now. And we want to make sure that that choice is known and that everyone recognizes it so that later on, if the choice has to be made, they will understand that some source of funding will have to be found, or there won't be a project anymore. And if there is no project at that point, we'll be left with a line in the Central Valley that has no particular value.
Tom Umberg, that would refer to the 130 miles you right. mentioned, Chowchilla to Bakersfield, and then it would take $18 billion more, I take it, to bring the rail line down to Los Angeles.
That's correct. That's right. But as to Lou's point, advocating that the legislature not approve the bonds is tantamount to killing the project. So that's the place where we find ourselves.
Why now, is that? Why is it the same thing as killing if the recommendation is wait until you can afford it?
Well, because the federal $3.5 billion of federal money would disappear. We wouldn't start the project. And as I mentioned, each year of delay adds $2 billion or more, maybe even $3 billion, to the cost of the project. So as it becomes more expensive to build the project, Our challenges don't go away. They increase in some ways almost exponentially. And now is the right time, especially to begin when we've got such a dramatic challenge economically with jobs and with interest rates being as low as they are and land prices right now being as low as this is the opportune time to start the project.
What about that, Lou Thompson? And would it be better if you found a different route? Instead of going from Chowchilla to Bakersfield to go closer to a population center, right now the polls are indicating that people are beginning to back away from this. That appears to be in part because they don't understand what the 130 miles is doing way out in the Central Valley.
Well, one of the things that we have argued is that the initial investment, at least a significant portion of it, should be shifted to the ends of the system rather than in the middle, because the ends are where the people are. The same work will have to be done for the same kind of service eventually, but you get a lot more payoff by starting where the people are and then building into the areas where they are not. The current San Joaquin service, which is through the valley, serves about 1 million people a year. The two ends where it would be improved if investment were put there serve about 28 million people or so a year. So it does, we think, make sense to consider that. But let me back up and say again, we did not recommend that the legislature cancel the project. What we said was there are a number of unanswered questions, which we have raised in every one of our reports, and that the legislature ought to have a better answer to those questions, or that it ought to clearly understand that there is no answer and that there are risks associated with moving ahead before they decide to make a decision. I'm in favor of high-speed rail. I have said that. I think every member of our committee is in favor of high-speed rail. But the factual reports and issues that we've been asked to consider, we have considered carefully, and this is our judgment.
Let's ask a couple of different kinds of questions. How important is high-speed rail to California's technological leadership? Has the state lost, or is it losing, its historic vision? Craig Hodgetts is an architect and designer. His firm rebuilt the Hollywood Bowl. He was co-designer of Living in a Modern Way, a very successful exhibition at LACMA about post-war construction in California. He's also a professor at UCLA School of Architecture. Craig Hodgetts, good to have you on our program.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for inviting me. This is interesting listening to the back and forth here, which I can tell you probably 50 years ago would have denied us all of the advantages which we're looking at right now. You know, during Pat Brown's governorship, the California Aqueduct and the which Lou referred to, and the university system and the highway system were all built at a time when, you know, you could drive from Santa Monica to downtown L.A. in maybe 10 minutes. At that point, and everyone would say, why do you need these huge freeways? And, you know, the argument about the sort of economic element should be sequestered, I think, and subordinated to a much larger, much more adventurous sort of vision, because this state has been, and, the thing that made the state great is that its vision was farsighted. Our society out here looked ahead, and by looking ahead, they gave us a quality of life here in Los Angeles and throughout California, which is, you know, the finest in the world. And not to continue to look ahead and to provide for the future, I think is a huge mistake.
During the years of Pat Brown, though, 50 years ago or so, the state had a lot more resources and a lot fewer people than it does now. It had the capacity to begin to build something huge, although it was difficult, as I think you have suggested, for Pat Brown to talk people into doing it even then. But isn't the state in a far different condition right now?
Well, of course it is at this very moment in time. But as Lou pointed out, the population is going to increase vastly. We're in a situation where we have to build lots and lots of more housing, lots and lots more schools. And if you look at the total picture, this is not such a huge piece of it. You have to look, I think, holistically at the development of the state. And we're talking about 20 years of development. And so incrementally, I just don't think this is that bitter a pill to swallow.
Just a correction. I think you've confused our other two guests.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's all right.
It's Tom that's making the arguments that you're suggesting, rather than Lou Thompson, who's with the peer review group. Lou Thompson, let me go back to you. Is it part of your responsibility on the peer review group to suggest to the legislature that they want to be adventurous and visionary and far-sighted, or are you able to do that?
I think I've said several times, I am in favor of high-speed rail. I just want the full picture of it, and the peer review group wants the full picture of it available to the legislature. The problem with farsightedness is that you often stumble over what's right beneath your feet. The California right now is in very serious financial trouble. We have no source available to us now to pay for this project if federal money is not available. And the financing plan is critically dependent on federal money. We simply want to make clear that this is a risk that we're taking. There are people who are happy to take that risk. There are others who are not. But it should at least be accurately understood. That's our objective.
Craig Hodgetts, what about the risk, and what if we don't take it? What are the consequences from a national and international standpoint?
Well, certainly from an international standpoint, the synergy between the two cities is going to, you know, which are really arguably the global center of technological innovation, that's going to diminish. We did a project last year in San Jose, and I commuted 2 days a week to that project by flying. It was tremendously encumbered by the long waits at the airport, the transition from an outlying airport into Silicon Valley, et cetera, et cetera. So the cost in terms of time and energy and fluidity of creative engagements is really very, very high. And I'm afraid that when we look at these economic forecasts, people are not ringing up the time lost by the 3 million or so people who will be going from L.A. to San Francisco right now, and probably the 5 million who will be traveling by 1930. So I think the costs are, you're going to have an overall savings in terms of man hours and time and effort.
Tom Umberg, again, chair of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. We just have a little less than a minute left. But what do you think of the prospects now for getting the legislature to agree to what Governor Brown wants, which is to sell $9 billion worth of bonds?
Well, I think the prospects are still good. I think that the legislature will adopt Craig's view. By the way, I could just continue to listen to Craig and not say anything. I think that benefits the project. But I think that they'll adopt Craig's view, is that for the long range, the long-term goals of California, maintaining our quality of life in our economy, we've got to have some vision. And now is the best time to start. So I think the legislature will go ahead and approve the bond sales.
Okay. Just want to reiterate what Lou Thompson said, that he's not against the project or against high-speed rail. He just has a responsibility to point out the risks. So Lou Thompson, again, is with the High-Speed Rail Peer Review Group. Tom Umberg is chair of the High-Speed Rail Authority. Craig Hodgetts is a principal of his own firm and a professor at the School of Architecture at UCLA. Thanks to you all for being on our program today.
Thank you, Warren.
Thank you, Warren.
You can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, Iowa's over. Let the campaign begin on Which Way LA. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. The Iowa caucuses did not produce a single delegate to the Republican nominating convention. They did not produce a clear winner. But they did force one candidate out of the race. Here's today's assessment from Michelle Bachman.
The people of Iowa spoke with a very clear voice, and so I have decided to stand aside. And I believe that if we are going to repeal Obamacare, turn our country around, and take back our country, we must do so united.
Michael Shearer is White House correspondent for Time magazine. He is on his way to New Hampshire, as are a lot of other people. Michael Shearer, it's good to have you back on our program.
Oh, always a pleasure to be here, Warren.
Let's do a rundown here of the results for those who haven't heard them as yet. Mitt Romney beat Rick Santorum by 8 votes.
Yeah, who would have guessed, right?
Yeah. What percentage of the vote did both of them ultimately get?
They're both right around 25%, a little more than 24%. What's notable about that is that this makes Mitt Romney really the lowest percentage gaining a winning winner in Iowa caucus history. When Mike Huckabee won it last time, he won it with about 30%. In previous years, the winners had even more. It shows, I think, in some ways, how fractured the Republican coalition remains in the wake of the George W. Bush presidency. You have these new forces like Ron Paul, who's bringing in a whole different crowd of voter. You have the traditional social conservatives, the traditional business wing, and it sort of fractured and pushed down everybody's margins.
Let's hear a bit of what Ron Paul had to say about all this.
Yeah, but I think we're in second place, and that's a good place to start. So I think we're going to have some momentum, and we're going to continue to do what we're doing. It's a live free or die state. They're very freedom oriented, so that message will spread there, and I'm confident we're going to do quite well.
Back to Michael Shearer with Time magazine. He said second place. Was he talking about polls in New Hampshire, or was that an early statement in Iowa?
Well, in New Hampshire, he is in second place in a lot of polls. You know, he also, though, did raise expectations, I think, a little too high in Iowa. He came in third, closer to 20%, and it was seen as a disappointment. A lot of people had really expected, you know, Paul even maybe coming away with a win out of New Hampshire, out of Iowa. And this goes to the oddity of this whole nominating process. Like you said, no delegates are really awarded here. It's all about expectations. It's all about the press buzz. It's all about sort of capturing the storyline in people's imagination as you move through these early states. Ron Paul is probably going to do very well again in New Hampshire, but it's not clear where he does next. Iowa and New Hampshire are probably his two strongest states. He can continue to pick up, you know, 10% or 15% of the vote in states afterwards, but he doesn't really have a path yet to the nomination.
Now we have Rick Santorum, who famously, of course, was way behind, as so other many others have been, and then jumped to the forefront just at exactly the right moment. Here's what he has to say.
God has given us this great country to allow his people, to be free. Has given us that dignity because we are a creation of his. And we need to honor that creation. And whether it's the sanctity of life in the womb or the dignity of every working person in America to fulfill their potential, you will have a friend in Rick Santorum. We are off to New Hampshire.
Michael Shearer, back to you. Obviously, Rick Santorum playing very heavily on the vote of Christian conservatives. How strong are they in New Hampshire?
Not strong. And you know, the other thing about Rick Santorum is he ended up at the right time filling this anybody but Romney bubble that had been filled by Kaine and Newt Gingrich and Rick Perry before him, but he has yet to get the blowback, and there just wasn't enough time, and Romney really wasn't interested in hitting Santorum coming down the wire in Iowa. And so there weren't too much negative stuff dropped on Santorum. You know, it's notable he, like others, doesn't have much of a campaign apparatus, even going into New Hampshire or South Carolina, where he's going to try and make a big stand, that he has run, and this is because this is who he is and he believes it, really as you know, when I first talked to him earlier this year, he talked of himself as being sort of trying to be the conscience of the party. He sees his candidacy very much in these moral terms, and like you heard him speak last night, it's not clear if that is going to be able to pass the bar of electability. And so I think Santorum has a more difficult ride now than even Mike Huckabee did coming out of Iowa, in which he had sort of laid the groundwork, laid the storyline. He's sort of sitting up there now at the top of the pack, and the Romney forces are going to be coming at him.
Michael Scherer, again, White House correspondent for Time magazine. Dean Spiliotis is professor at Southern New Hampshire University. He blogs at nhpoliticalcapital.com. Good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren. Good to be back with you.
So we have these three people now who came out the strongest in Iowa. We have, of course, also former Governor Huntsman, who's been campaigning in New Hampshire. How do you think they stack up in your state?
Well, three that you mentioned, Mitt Romney, John Huntsman, and Ron Paul, all have pretty well-developed grassroots organizations on the ground here. Rick Santorum is the only one of that group. You know, he's who doesn't really have that. You know, he's been here, I think he said last night, he's been in New Hampshire around 30 times. He was polling at about 5%. I know last night CNN did a flash poll of voters watching the caucus coverage, and he had jumped up to maybe 10%. So I think it's a difficult road for him here in New Hampshire. I think that I didn't see anything last night in Mitt Romney's victory that would lead me to question his substantial 30, sometimes 40 percentage point ranking in the polls here. You know, there's always a chance for a surprise, and Newt Gingrich has said he's going to campaign here, and the sense is that he's going to go after Mitt Romney very aggressively. But, you know, I think one of the things we've seen in this campaign cycle is a number of these candidates, whether it's, you know, Michelle Bachmann or Rick Santorum or even Herman Cain or Newt Gingrich, you know, they surge to the polls based on kind of national coverage, but they don't really have the kind of grassroots organizational infrastructure under them. And that's the case for Santorum. So anything he's going to get together in the state is really going to be a product of whatever happens this week. And I think the earlier comments about the fragmentation in the party are well taken. I think that's a consideration for Romney as well. But he's in pretty good shape in the state here. The only potential drawback for Romney would be if he wins, but expectations here are so high that maybe he wins by 8 or 10 or 12 points. That could conceivably be used as a potential weakness, that he didn't live up to his potential in the state. And you know, the reality is Rick Santorum just needs to show some kind of juice coming out of Iowa, you know, some sort of energy or juice just to show that he's viable. Doesn't need to really finish first or second here, and then he can probably raise some money and live to fight again in South Carolina.
You mentioned Newt Gingrich, who, of course, in Iowa was attacked by the Romney Political Action Committee, not by the campaign itself, but by organization using big money to support Romney. Gingrich was attacked, made a lot of statements about negative campaigning, how he wasn't going to do that. Here's what he's saying now.
We are not going to go out and run nasty ads. We're not going to go out and run 30-second gotcha ads. We're not. But I do reserve the right to tell the truth. And if the truth seems negative, that may be more a comment on his record than it is on politics.
Back to Dean Spiliotis at Southern New Hampshire University. Hasn't the Gingrich campaign already taken out a couple of negative newspaper ads in New Hampshire?
Yeah, that was one of my favorite comments last night.
Whenever
you're the one doing the negative campaigning and attacking, it's just truth-telling. Yeah, I mean, the thing that's gotten the most publicity is that they took out a full-page ad in the Union Leader, which is the New Hampshire Union Leader. It's the conservative newspaper of record here. They endorsed Newt Gingrich. There's been a sense that he hasn't really made the fullest advantage of that endorsement the way he might have if he had spent a bit more time in the state. So, you know, he has this contrast, what they would call a contrast ad, with Mitt Romney. You know, he's in sort of nice full color on one side of the page, and Romney's in kind of evil-looking black and white on the other side of the page. And then it lists, you know, sort of the, sort of negative contrast between Gingrich and Romney. And, we, and a lot of people have been reporting that, you know, Gingrich has gone so far to call Romney a liar about his record. So, you know, the question is going to be sort of how far is Gingrich willing to go to try to take Romney down? Does he have enough money to do it? Because all of this negative advertising certainly costs a lot of money. So that's another potential wild card. I don't know that Gingrich has all that much energy left here in the state. He's peaked here as he did elsewhere. But, you know, if he can chip away at Romney's lead to some extent where Romney maybe doesn't have quite a big victory, that may provide an opening for some other candidate.
Let me go back to Michael Scherer, a White House correspondent for Time magazine. It would appear that with Santorum coming on at the end as he did, there was sort of nobody else left to be the alternative to Romney, which is what the voters seem to be looking for. And as you've both pointed out, he didn't get a lot of the attacks that other leaders did when they rose out of the pack. What do you think this says about Romney?
I think Romney's been incredibly lucky this time around, is what it says. I mean, Romney, I think, very adroitly understood the playing field he was in. You know, you talk to Romney advisors and you say, what's the biggest difference between candidate Romney in 2008 and candidate Romney in 2011? And they say two things. One, in 2008, he tried to do too many things, tried to be too many things to too many people, and he didn't understand the field on which he was playing. And this time around, Romney really has a feel for who he is, what he's trying to present himself to be, and also the playing field, who he's playing against. He saw a danger from Rick Perry, went very negative very quickly, and with Perry's help, was able to basically disqualify Perry, although Perry's hoping still for a comeback in South Carolina. Newt Gingrich came up and, with his super PAC's help and his own campaign, also basically eliminated Newt Gingrich from the equation in Iowa. You know, the only thing that can really cause problems for Romney right now is if the anybody but Romney faction of the Republican Party is able to come together around one person, probably in South Carolina. If it takes longer than South Carolina for this to happen, it'll probably be too late. And it's still a possibility. I mean, you still have these candidates who've gone down. Rick Perry said today he's not actually going to drop out of the race. He's going to South Carolina. He's the one who can actually raise the money most easily to do this. And I think the hope of all these candidates, Newt, Santorum, and Perry, is that those people who really don't want to see Romney as their nominee, which are a significant percentage of the party, although many of them don't feel so strongly about it, they'd rather just beat Obama, that portion of the party really, you know, hits the panic button and decides to close ranks around one person. And we haven't seen that happen yet.
Let me introduce Dave Leventhal. He's money and politics reporter for Politico, and it's good to have you back on our show as well.
Good to be with you.
Should point out that John McCain today endorsed Mitt Romney, the establishment in the party beginning to form around him, as they have been doing, I should say, for some time. But how important has the super PAC been and the big money that was allowed by the recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court?
It's been incredibly important. And just ask Newt Gingrich, who got waylaid by millions upon millions of dollars of advertisements that had been sponsored by a pro-Mitt Romney super PAC. In fact, this pro-Mitt Romney super PAC, it's called Restore Our Future, had actually spent more in Iowa. We don't have the exact final numbers yet, but spent more in Iowa than the Romney campaign actually spent in Iowa. So for anyone who says that super PACs, they're not really a factor, that's absolutely ludicrous. They are one of the biggest factors, at least in Iowa, that we had going.
How big a difference is there between Restore Our Future and the Romney campaign in terms of the people in charge?
Well, there's actually some very, very close ties, not only with Restore Our Future and Romney, but another super PAC called Winning Our Future, which is supportive of Newt Gingrich, and several of the other super PACs that have sprung up in the aftermath of a couple of key federal court decisions in 2010 that allowed for the creation of these types of committees, where you have former staffers who are running them and supporting the candidates, even though, by the letter of the law, they are not supposed to directly coordinate with the campaigns. But yet we see time and again that many former staffers, many intimates, close associates are actually the ones who are forming the biggest, the most wealthy, the most moneyed super PACs that are going into many of these early states, Iowa not only, but New Hampshire, South Carolina, Florida, and spending hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, in these independent expenditures that fuel communications, television, radio, mailers, phone banking, et cetera.
We've heard that Gingrich doesn't have much of an organization in New Hampshire, but what about Winning Our Future? Could that PAC bring him up? Do they have enough money to put him back on the map in New Hampshire?
It certainly has money, but the great irony in all of this is that we don't have the numbers for these super PACs as to how much money they have actually raised. And it's a legal loophole that has effectively allowed these super PACs to occlude their funders until the end of January. And that's a big deal, and here's why. It means that the Iowa caucuses, as well as the first three primary contests, are going to pass without these super PACs having to tell the public who's behind these millions upon millions of dollars in ads and other communications that they're producing. So not exactly a victory for transparency if you care about such a thing.
David Leventhal, again, Money and Politics reporter for Politico. As we've heard, Mitt Romney won by 8 votes over Rick Santorum, getting his sort of standard 25% of the Republican vote. Today, he did very much what he has been doing, and he did this last night as well. Not what his super PAC is doing, which is attack the other Republicans, but to zero in on President Obama. He said the president, who might be a nice guy, but who's just over his head.
4 years ago tonight, he was giving a victory celebration speech here in Des Moines. And he'd been going across the state making all sorts of promises. The gap between his promises 4 years ago and his performance is as great as anything I've ever seen in my life.
Gary Langer is president of Langer Research Associates. He polls for ABC News. And Gary Langer, it's always good to have you on our show.
Thanks, Warren.
We've heard that line and lines like it from Mitt Romney again and again and again and again. He pretty much sticks to the script.
Yeah, well, you know, he plays a lot better against Barack Obama than he does against some of his Republican opponents. He continues to struggle to win some key elements of the Republican Party. And what we saw in the polls in advance of Iowa, we saw in play in Iowa, in which Romney did no better in Iowa, despite all his time and spending in the state, than he did in 2008. Actually did worse among very conservative voters and among evangelicals, those two groups in which he's really had trouble. There are these core elements of the Republican Party that have been yearning and searching for some alternative. They found for the moment some of them, Rick Santorum. Whether that goes on or not, we'll see. But Romney leaves Iowa with a victory, if you want to call it that, but certainly with some significant bruises that are going to take some time to heal.
He's got a week to do what Dean Spiliotis says he thinks he will do, and that is win in New Hampshire. But there is this expectations issue, as Dean Spiliotis mentioned. What about it? How much does he have to win by in New Hampshire to stay credible?
Well, a substantial margin in New Hampshire is necessary for Romney, but he's likely to get it. He's virtually a resident of the state. He's got a summer home there. He spent a lot of time. Was next state governor. Has a very substantial lead, and it's hard to see who performs strongly against him in New Hampshire. Now, Ron Paul, perhaps. The really funny thing about Ron Paul's showing in Iowa is that a majority, 53% of Ron Paul's supporters in the Iowa Republican caucuses, did not define themselves as Republicans. He drew independents and a few Democrats who showed up. So where he goes, Ron Paul, in the Republican Party is hard to see. But New Hampshire is a state where a lot of independents participate. It's an open primary. And that could work for Paul if he can get his message across. Santorum, it's challenging, as we've heard, to see how he plays well. Gingrich has been on the fade. So Romney should do well in New Hampshire. But if he does, it just sort of will be taken as a pass, as what you might expect. And on we go to South Carolina and Florida. And this could drag out for some time again if there's some coalescing of these anyone but Romney voters around some plausible alternative. If not, ultimately they'll line up behind Romney. I might add that this notion that Romney won in Iowa, it kind of reminds me of the famous headline in the Harvard Crimson after a college football game in 1968. It said Harvard beats Yale 29-29.
So you say Gingrich is on the fade, but Gingrich doesn't say that. He has this super PAC winning our freedom, I think it's called. I can't read my note here, but we don't know how much money he's got. But what if he comes on strong in New Hampshire?
Yeah, look, it's not impossible. But look, the Republicans who have been yearning for some alternative to Mitt Romney have been flipping the cards. There was the Bachman and the Perry and the Kane, and we got around to Gingrich. There's a reason he was the fourth card flip, not the first, and that is he carries some baggage for many Republicans. And as soon as that was made apparent through the advertising that the Romney-related PAC put up, he went down in the polls. And now we come to Santorum. And it's really all part of this continuing search for some alternative to Romney. But New Hampshire is a more moderate state. It's one that in many ways is pretty well built for a Romney candidacy. And that's why Romney's done well in the state. He's been polling well there, and the expectation is that he'll be strong there. More challenging for him is what comes next, particularly as we move south into more conservative states, states with more evangelical voters, and states who really have Republicans that are as interested in leading with their heart as with their head. That's the challenge with the Romney candidacy.
Gary Langer, pollster for ABC News. Dave Leventhal, back to you, money and politics reporter for Politico. What about South Carolina and Rick Perry? He's not going to New Hampshire. But how much of a dent do you think he could make in South Carolina as this search goes on, apparently, for the anti-Romney Republican candidate?
Rick Perry does not have a lot of things going for him right now. About the only thing that he does have going for him is money. He still has several million dollars, from what we can tell, in his own account. He has a super PAC that has been very active as well, that also has millions upon millions of dollars. It was incredibly active in Iowa, did not do him a whole lot of good in the end, but it might play better, and the messages that it's putting out may play better in a South Carolina as opposed to an Iowa. So this is really his last stand. He knows it. Everyone else knows it, and he's probably going to unload his clip, which is filled with millions of dollars as it stands right now.
Would you expect him to attack Romney?
He'll probably do anything that he sees that he could possibly do in order to get a boost in the polls, and knocking off Romney would certainly be one of the things that he would think to do first. But he's got some large issues. He's got to reintroduce himself effectively to an entire electorate and somehow just beat the dog on him that he is incapable of being a face for the nation, somebody who can't even have a debate performance that's worthy of a presidential candidate. So he's got a lot of ground to make up in the next couple of weeks.
Dean Spiliotis at Southern New Hampshire University. What about the independents and the Democrats who voted for Ron Paul and the idea that New Hampshire has a lot of independent-minded voters? Is he liable to appeal to them? And even if he doesn't beat Romney, which would seem very unlikely, could he come out second?
Certainly a possibility. You know, he traditionally has had a cap in the state of about, 14 to 15% of the vote, and I think that's kind of what people have been suggesting for him this time around. We are a fairly libertarian state. We have our largest group of voters are called registered undeclared, where you don't declare a party, and that allows you to pick which primary you want to vote in on primary day. So it's quite possible he will draw a fair number of non-traditional, non-Republican voters into the primary. But we haven't really seen what we haven't seen from Paul is any sense that he could really come up closer to Romney. We also have John Huntsman in the mix who. Has kind of gone back and forth between making the argument that he's kind of more electable and more moderate and then saying that he's the true conservative. So, he may pick up some of those voters as well. We had thought all along that if he was going to succeed, it would probably be at the expense of Mitt Romney, and that hasn't really happened, which is why I think he's also been stuck in the teens. So, I didn't see anything special about Ron Paul's performance last night that would lead me to believe that he's going to have any special kind of momentum here, but he does do well with – kind of non-traditional primary voters, and those undeclared voters are the biggest block of voters in our state.
Dave Leventhal, presuming that Paul does do well in New Hampshire for the sake of argument, then it's on to South Carolina. One of his appeals, particularly to young people, has been his isolationism, his statements about how we don't need to go to war with Iran or try to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. How would that go in South Carolina?
It may not play as well as some other states, although the state has a large population of younger people who definitely have found Ron Paul to largely be the candidate of their choice if they are Republicans. But Paul has had this problem that in the early states that he has in many of these states going forward, most likely, which is that he's never going to pull 40, 45, 50%, even in a field that would be winnowed down to about two or three candidates. He sort of has a natural built-in ceiling that he saw in 2008 when he was running for president, where he's just having a lot of difficulty getting behind or getting beyond that core, very passionate support group that he has out for him. But his appeal to the larger Republican electorate has been something that has largely eluded him both the last election cycle and this election cycle.
Thanks to you all, Gary Langer at Langer Research Associates, polling for ABC News, David Leventhal, money and politics reporter for Politico, Dean Spiliotis, professor, Southern New Hampshire University, blogging at nhpoliticalcapital.com, and Michael Scherer, the White House correspondent for Time magazine. Great to have all of you on our program today, and thanks very much for joining us. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Christian Bordahl with Caitlin Schamberg and Francis Anderton. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can email us, share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla. Join the conversation on Which Way LA's Facebook page. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation and the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation.